Okay, my name is Grace Scheibel. My official name is really Grace Berg Scheibel, and it's the name I use professionally. I was born in Tacoma, Washington, but that was mere accident of birth. My family had been longtime Alaskan residents prior to my birth, and my mother chose to have her third child born in the United States and not the territory of Alaska. So she went outside when she was 9 months pregnant and brought me back when I was a couple of months old. I was raised in Juneau. All of my elementary education was in Juneau. Graduated from Juneau High School, 1943. I worked for 2 years prior to going to college because my father thought I was too young to go off to college by myself. This, of course, was during the Second World War. And I worked 1 year for the U.S. Forest Service for a man who later became governor of Alaska, B. Frank Heintzelman. And I worked 1 year for the superintendent of schools in Juneau and got my teaching certificate as a high school graduate. They were desperately short of teachers, and I was teaching office arts at that point. And when I was teaching and working as secretary to the superintendent of schools in Juneau, Dr. Bunnell, who was president of the University of Alaska, visited and persuaded me that this was the appropriate place for me to go for at least a year or two, rather than going off to Northwestern University, where I had been accepted for a year or two, and then transferring to George Washington University, which had the only undergraduate school of government open to women. And so I came to the University of Alaska with the intention of spending 1 and possibly 2 years and then transferring directly to George Washington University. And that's precisely what I did. I stayed here 2 years and then went to George Washington University for my junior year and hopefully training for a career in the Foreign Service. I wanted to be a consular officer. The climate was such in the District of Columbia and in the State Department at that time. It was not the best course of action for me. And besides, I missed Alaska so much, I could hardly wait to get back. So I persuaded my family that it would probably be just as well for me to come home and get a degree from the University of Alaska, which we thought could open a lot of doors that would otherwise be closed because there aren't that many graduates from the University of Alaska who go on to other things. And we thought it might help getting admitted to the schools I wanted to get admitted to. So I came back and I graduated from the University of Alaska, and this was a time of transition at the Dr. Bunnell, Charles E. Bunnell, who incidentally had been a U.S. District Court judge, was the president of the university and had been the first and only president, was retiring to become president emeritus. And at that time, the new president had been selected, and I had worked part-time for Dr. Bunnell when I was in college. And so he asked me to stay on during the transition, and so I did. And I stayed for a year as a secretary to the president of the university. And then I left and decided to go back to southeastern Alaska, start accumulating money so I could go into graduate school. I had decided that I really wanted to teach history. That was my great ambition, but I needed money to go on. And went back to southeastern and did a variety of things, had a great time, got my graduate work lined up, and then went back to graduate school at GW, George Washington University. And spent 2 years, got my master's. I would come home in the summertime and work on my thesis, which was a study of Alaska legislation for the period from 1921 to 1933, what Alaskans always referred to as the Great Republican Blackout. I wanted to do, my master's thesis was in three areas. Not three areas, several areas of legislation, but I dealt with federal legislation and territorial legislation. And I also dealt with editorial comment on the legislation. But I would come home in the summer and work on my thesis. The university asked me if I was prepared to teach at one point, and I said, no, I really wasn't, because I hadn't finished my thesis. One of the professors had left unexpectedly, and they needed somebody desperately in the history department. I wasn't prepared. And then the next thing I knew, I was offered a job with the Legislative Council, which had just been established. And that had a little more appeal to me, because I would be able to finish my thesis in Juneau, where the historical library was.
That was 1953?
1953. I'd finished all my coursework, but I hadn't finished redrafting my thesis, and I still needed some of the references that were available there, particularly the newspapers. And so I took the job with the Legislative Council and thoroughly enjoyed that. I worked for them from the fall of 53 to the fall of 55. During the time I was working for the council, I decided I really didn't think I wanted to teach, but law had some great appeal. And I thought, well, I'll go to law school and I'll come back and I'll head up the Legislative Council. I enjoy the legislative research. My major weakness, of course, was my inability to draft legislation. I simply could not understand the decisional law well enough to be able to figure out how to draft something that would pass muster. So I thought law school would be the appropriate thing at that point. And I was going with a man who wanted me to be sure to come back east again. And so I looked at all the eastern law schools, and I picked Yale because of its great experience with women, and made application to Yale. And I was told that's, you know, the dumbest thing in the world you can do, just to apply to one law school. But I lucked out and was accepted and went to Yale. And my second term, I became ill and had to drop out, return to Alaska. After a few weeks, I went right back to work for the Legislative Council, and the director left. And I was the acting director for a few months, and then went back to law school.
Who had been the director?
Jack McKay. And he left to become one of the county administrators in Alameda County.
When did you graduate law school?
Well, I finished my coursework in January of 1959, and actually got my degree in the following June. And of course, I got married on Christmas Day in 1958. And my husband was from Fairbanks. So I returned to Fairbanks, and then we left immediately for South Africa for 2 months. And when I came back, Ed Mertes and Henry Camerill, both of whom I'd known in Juneau, were practicing law in Fairbanks, and they invited me to clerk for their law firm, maybe Mertes, Camerill, and Fitzgerald. And so I did. Then I studied for the bar, took the bar, was admitted to practice. and I practiced with McNeely and Mertes, Camero and Fitzgerald, McNeely, Mertes and Camero, McNeely and Mertes, until we formed our own law firm in 1966. Incidentally, I think I'm the first person who was admitted to practice after the old territorial courts were dissolved. Everyone who took the bar in 1959 Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau were admitted the day before the transition. And unfortunately, I was in Anchorage, and they wouldn't transfer the admission papers to Anchorage so I could be admitted there. And the transition came and I came back, and then the arrangements had to be made for me to be admitted. And I was on the 23rd of February, 1960, the day after Washington's birthday.
Let me ask you a few questions. When did your parents first come to Alaska?
My father came in 1912.
For what purpose?
He came up to look for gold. There was a big gold strike in the what we call the Shoshina country, the Chisoshina.
Where is that?
It's north of Cordova. It's close to the Nabesna area. And of course he didn't find any gold. Returned to the Seattle area. My father was an immigrant from Norway. And he returned to the Seattle area where he had some very distant relatives. But on the return trip, he had spent time on the ship going through southeastern Alaska, decided it was very much like his native Norway, got to Seattle, turned around, came right back to Alaska, and lived here until he died.
Did he meet your mother in Juneau?
And my mother was an immigrant from Sweden. And they both happened to come to this country the same year. They both came on the Mauritania, from Liverpool to New York, and my father came on the first trip of the Mauritania in May, and my mother came on the second trip in May, and then they met 5 years later when my mother came to Alaska I think she was going to come for 2 months to visit her sister who was living there, and she met my father, and they were married. And
how many children in your family?
Three. I have an older brother and an older sister.
Are they all in Alaska?
No, my brother is. My sister lives in California.
When you were in Juneau, were you aware of the lawyers in town?
Oh, sure.
Who were the lawyers that were in town?
Well, the one I probably knew the best was Bert Faulkner, mm-hmm. because his son Malcolm was in my high school class. Well, we went through school together. And so I knew Bert and Roma Faulkner from the time I can first remember. Bob Robertson, and Bob and Carol Robertson, Mike Monagle, Fred Eastall came later. Gosh, it's hard to remember when you're a kid. Mildred Herman, of course, because Barbara and Chi were both friends. I don't know what Chi's real name is. I think it's Russell. Yeah. Russell. But Barbara and Chi were both friends. Grover Wynn. Susie Wynn is a friend of mine.
Can you describe Bert Faulkner to me a little?
Physically?
Physically, yeah.
Physically? Well, I always thought of him as a very tall man, and I don't really know whether he was or not. Kind of stern looking, but I knew he wasn't, because he was just such a really nice man. Physically he looked to me like what judges should look like. He was dark haired, rather strong features, and he just, he was always so super dignified.
What about Bob Robertson?
Bob Robertson is the kind of man I think I best remember out of his summer place, which is a place that we used to visit a lot when we were kids. We'd go over there by boat. The Robertsons and the Simpsons had cabins next to each other at Auchnoo, and we used to wander over there as kids by boat. And I can remember him in the Filson suit, the tuxedo, the Alaskan tuxedo. A lot of times just in a plaid shirt. And they had the best gooseberry patch in the world. And I just remember him as a very nice, pleasant man who was, he didn't really ignore little kids, but he didn't pay that much attention to them either. But as I was older, as I grew older, I joined the Pioneers at the same time that Bob, my mother, my father, and Bob and Carol Robertson and I all joined the same night, joined the Pioneers of Alaska.
Mike Monagle, if you remember
him. I remember darn little of Mike Monagle as a kid. I got to know him a little better as I grew older because he lived very close to my parents. Mm-hmm. But as a kid, I really didn't know. I knew he was a lawyer, and I knew that he was with Bob Robertson in the practice of law. But I really don't remember much about him. I remember his sister far better, Rosellen Willebrand.
When you were older, what do you remember Mike Monagle?
Well, mostly that he had the reputation for being the sharpest lawyer in town. And it wasn't always meant kindly. And this was before I became a lawyer. That, he was a shrewd, sharp lawyer, and you always had to watch out for him. That is the impression that I had of him. But, that after I'd, I think after I had gone to graduate school and came back, my impressions of lawyers had changed considerably because I'd done so much work in just plain legislative history. And of course, our territorial legislature was overloaded with attorneys. I just had a different attitude towards lawyers.
Tell me your before and after attitude. What was your attitude before you went and did your
of lawyers? Well, you had people like Bert Faulkner, whom I admired from day one, because he was just such an outstanding citizen. He and my father were also Masons, and I know that this colored my views as a child. The people who were belonged to the same milieu that my family belonged to. Even though we were really outsiders in Juneau, because my parents were immigrants, we weren't part of the great social structure, the top layer of the social structure in Juneau. My brother and my sister and I were better than average students, and of course this helped.
What's the top social structure in Juneau?
The top social structure in Juneau were all the people connected with Alaska Juneau Gold Mine.
Would that be the Helen Falls? Were there
were a lot of people, and a lot of the names I don't even remember now, the people that were connected with the mines, the top layers in the mine, and the professional people, the doctors and the lawyers. Mm-hmm. But they were pretty much the, and of course, the bankers, the barons. Family, the Mullins, the Barons and the Mullins, the McLeans. I can't even remember the names of some of those bankers. But I always considered people like George Parks and, Frank Heinzelman, the Robertsons, Faulkners, the Williams. He was the head of the mine in the last years that it was open.
But those Banfield?
Banfield was really, you know, his wartime cream. But prior to that time, no.
Monocles?
I don't think the Monocles ever were. The Goldsteins, the whole Goldstein Simpson family.
Why weren't the Monocles?
Well, I think it's partly religious. You know, they were Catholics. And,
but the Jewish ones were okay? Goldsteins and the Simpsons?
Yes. Mm-hmm. No, it's an odd, well, Isidore Goldstein, Charlie Goldstein's brother, was the mayor of Juneau when I was a child. And he ran a ship's chandlery store, as I recall. And of course, Charlie Goldstein had the Goldstein building and the fur store, the far-flung interests of the Goldsteins, and Belle Simpson, of course, had the nugget shop. Her husband was an optometrist. And their kids were, you know, all doing very well. But those are my memories of the social structure in Juneau, and we were never really part of that, except, you know, on our age level, we were never excluded because our parents were immigrants, even though my parents felt that they were excluded a lot of times.
What was the reputation of these lawyers in the community? How do people feel about lawyers when you were growing up?
Well, I think that it was an entirely personal. I don't think you could say that there was any one feeling about lawyers. I think that the general reputation of the legal profession was very high, far higher than it is today, or even as it was during the Second World War. I felt that the lawyers and the doctors and the bankers were just sort of of people of integrity, character, you know, just grew up looking up to these people. They were very good role models for young people coming along.
Henry Roden, do you remember Henry Roden from this
time? Oh, yes. Well,
a little later.
I think Henry Roden was later. I'm trying to think of the first time I met him. I know he was deeply involved with the development at Pelican, and I don't know whether he was spending time out there or where he was, but I don't remember him until probably the late 40s. Mm-hmm. That's my first real memory of him.
In the legislature?
I don't know that. No, I don't think he was. I think he may have been Attorney General. I can't remember. Yeah, I think he was Attorney General before Jerry. Yeah, and that would have been about the first time that I really became aware of him. And I really didn't get to appreciate Henry Roden until I started piecing together that the Henry Roden I had been reading about as the lawyer from the Iditarod was the same Henry Roden that I was meeting now. You know, it took me a long time to put the pieces together. This is the same man who had been a great lawyer in the Iditarod and in the Fairbanks area.
What did you hear about Henry Roden?
Well, when I was here as a student, you know, that he was the best mining lawyer around. That, you know, that if Wickersham had used him to clean up the mess, that it would have taken Wickersham half the time. Of course, I knew Wickersham as a kid. But Wickersham, to me, wasn't a lawyer. He was a politician, and you know, I knew that he was a judge, and I knew that he and Judge Bunnell didn't get along very well. One was a Republican, one was a Democrat. But Wickersham, to me, was a politician. I never thought of him really as a lawyer. I knew he was. Yes, in 16 or 18, run against him as the for the delegate to Congress.
So Wickersham wasn't a lawyer, though. He didn't have a stature of lawyer.
It was a politician in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Politicians had lower stature.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Did Juno feel that way about their politics?
I don't think so. Politicians were honored people in our household, basically. Mm-hmm. But, because I come from a very political family, very political. I think the major topic at the dinner table was what's going on the local and the territorial level, not so much on the national level, mm-hmm. because we had one delegate to Congress, and without a vote, couldn't really do a great deal. I mean, we knew a lot about national politics, but the concentration was on the local and the territorial.
How was your family involved in politics?
I think immigrants make the best citizens, excuse me, but I think they do. And my parents never failed to vote. Mm-hmm. The first time they ever voted for president, which was in 1960, they had at that point normally spent their winters in Arizona. But they did not in 1960 because they said, the first time that we get to vote for the president of the United States, we're going to do it, cast our ballot in person. None of this absentee ballot nonsense for us, not the first time. But I think that my family was very much involved with the whole election process because they were immigrants, something that, yes, they might have taken part in some things in their native lands, but certainly never to the extent that they were permitted to as U.S. citizens.
What were the topics that were discussed in the early years, but were things that were real important in the territory?
In the territory? Fish traps.
Mm-hmm. Or against?
Well, my family was dead set against the traps. Mm-hmm. Because to us they represented outside absentee owners. There were very few fish traps owned by Alaskans. They were all owned by the large absentee landlords. Taxes, that came later, but there was an awful lot of talk about taxes and the need for the territory to set up some kind of taxing scheme. Perhaps to prevent the absentee landlord. Mining and what was happening to mining was extremely important. Juneau was a mining town. I can remember, hearing the mine emergency whistle, blasts go off. I had lots of friends whose fathers worked in the mine.
So mining conditions.
Uh-huh, mining conditions. I became very aware of labor when I was a little kid. My father had a contract to do paving in Juneau, and it was the first United Mine Workers called strike at the AJ Mine. And I used to occasionally go down to the rock dump where they were loading the rock to do the fill-in for the paving in Juneau, and to go through the lines of the pickets wasn't much fun as a little kid. They were, picketing on both sides of the street down by the old rock dump. So, there were just a lot of changes happening in the territory. The governors were people that you knew. You lived in Juneau, you knew the governors. You may not know them well, but you certainly knew them, and you certainly knew them by sight. Governor Troy's granddaughter was a girl I used to play with. George Parks had no children, but George Parks was a very kind man, is a very kind man. And he knew my father, and knew my father fairly well, so I was one of the kids that, respectfully spoke to him. And he'd always acknowledge your presence. And when I was out of high school, of course, I got to know him better because he and Frank Heinzelman were good friends.
Yeah.
And I was working for Frank. Wickersham, incidentally, when he moved back to Juneau from Washington, D.C., asked my father to redesign this house for him, what is called the Wickersham House now, and put in a library. Would you like some Kleenex?
Oh, no, I'm fine. I'm just kidding. I get choked up and look like, yeah.
But my father did put in his new library in his house. And Judge Wickersham said to my father, you know, I know you have young children. Maybe they'd like some of these books. And so he gave me two whole sets of books. One, The History of the Peoples of the World, which was on India paper. But it had marvelous things like Prescott's work in it, and, you know, some of the very famous historical treatises. And I had those until I got married and I decided I just didn't have room for them anymore.
What about
a
Milgram Herman?
Well, Mildred Herman was a lawyer, and she was a woman lawyer, and it was fascinating, but more fascinating was her size.
I heard so many stories about her size. Yes. Go ahead, tell me about her size.
Well, she was a very large, large woman. I don't know what she weighed, but I bet she weighed 300 pounds.
What's her background, do you know?
I don't know anything about her background. All I know is that, you know, Mildred Herman was a lawyer, her husband was a druggist, and there was Barbara and Chi, and, you know, of course I knew both of them. But I know nothing about Mildred's legal background. She became the head of OPA during the war, and, you know, big politician.
Republican.
I don't know what she was. I don't know what her politics. Yes, she'd have to be a Republican. I don't even remember whether she ever served. I think she ran for the legislature, but I don't know that she ever served.
Were lawyers in different classes? Were some lawyers you'd look up to and other lawyers that weren't as well known or as well respected?
Well, there were. Oh, I think I, as a child, I had a lot of my father's built-in prejudices, okay? Taking that into account, yes, I think there were probably some lawyers who were highly respected and others that were not so highly respected. Grover Wynne, for example, was not a highly respected lawyer. It may have been only in our household, but he certainly wasn't.
Why?
I don't know. But he was not, he was not considered the most competent lawyer, and I think he probably drank a little bit too much.
Was it the kind of practice he had, that he had criminal practice?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Were there other lawyers in the same categories?
Mike Monagle, to a certain extent, in the very early years, and again, I think on behalf of my family and probably the friends, it was because he was Roman Catholic, and this was not a strong Roman Catholic community. I don't think that Will Paul was practicing at the time, but he would be in and out of Juneau, and I'd see him, and I can remember, you know, he had a partner whose name was Steele. And I think both of them were named Will. And I know that my father used to say, Will Paul, Will Steele. But he was not a highly respected lawyer. His wife was a dearly beloved woman in Juneau. Mm-hmm. And his daughter, of course, was one of my very favorite vocalists. She was a couple of years ahead of me in school.
What about his son, Fred?
Fred I didn't know at all in those days. Or Will Jr. I didn't know either one of those. I mean, I know who they are. There was another son, Raymond, and I don't even know what happened to him.
After you did some legislative work and your opinion about lawyers changed, how did it change?
Well, I think I came to understand that uh, that the law is sometimes very difficult to bend to the needs of your client. And that, you know, there's, you may have, well, it's just a very entirely realistic view of the law, that it can do certain things and do them well, but it does a lousy job on most things. And, but it's, you know, it's being very philosophical about it, it's just a mechanism for people to resolve disputes. And it's a very imperfect mechanism. And before I think I always had the idealistic view that justice is what is going to come out of the system. And after working in legislative work for a little while, you found out that that's not it. You know, even the law is a compromise, and it's a very imperfect tool for resolving disputes.
How did that make you view the lawyer, that they are in?
Well, I can't.
The reputation results from this imperfect.
I think part of it does. Yes, I think that the layman has no view of the lawyer as working with an imperfect tool. Mm-hmm. I think that they're still wanting to achieve justice, which is something I don't think that you achieve necessarily with the law, and because we don't achieve their ultimate justice, we're failures, and therefore are not something to be honored. I also feel that there are a lot of incompetent lawyers, a lot of lazy lawyers. There's a whole generation of lawyers for whom generally I have very little respect.
Which generation?
And I think it's the generation that came out of law school basically at the same time I did.
So the late 50s, early 60s?
Mm-hmm. Late 50s, early 60s.
Why is there this?
And I'm just speaking very generally. I just think that they don't have a dedication to the practice of law, that the practice of law is just a stepping stone to something else.
Political ambitions?
Political ambitions, business ambitions. That they don't view the practice of law as an end.
Did people before statehood up in Alaska, many of whom didn't go to law school, weren't they also heavily involved in politics? Many of them?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. But you don't feel that this wasn't the same?
No. No. No, because politics in Alaska, when I was a kid, was a 60-day, and I'm talking about territorial politics, mm-hmm. was 60 days biennially. It's not 6 months every year type of thing that it is today. Yeah. And they accomplish their business in 60 days every other year. Yeah. But life was a lot less complex, too. I recognize that.
You consider them more dedicated practitioners?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. But I have, you know, I'm not saying that that is a change that's gone on, because I think that, you know, watching the younger generation coming up, people that have come out of law school in the 70s and who are practicing in Alaska, I just, you know, I have the utmost admiration for them, because they're far more idealistic than I was. Mm-hmm. And I think that they're even far more dedicated than I am, and I think they're better scholars.
What happened between 60 and 70 to cause this?
I don't know.
Any idea?
Well, I think that Vietnam, the whole era of the 60s, which really started in the 50s, you had a lot of uncertainties in the 50s that weren't very pleasant for a lot of people. The whole McCarthy era scared the living daylights out of a lot of people, and they tended to lie low. And I think that low visibility a lot of times is a comfortable thing, that you're not going to become involved in controversy, you're not going to do anything, you're not going to rock the boat. That whole attitude coming out of the McCarthy, then moving into the Vietnam, the whole era of protest, the whole era of civil rights, where, yes, visibility, if you were the right person at the right time, wasn't bad, but visibility, if you were the wrong person in the wrong place, could be very bad for you. And then the whole protest movement, people got so involved in those things. There was an awful lot of me generation in the 60s. I just think that that era didn't produce the best lawyers, either the ones who wanted to lie low, hide their light under a bushel, or who just were part of the me generation. You know, I'm going to do what pleases me.
When you were working with the legislature in the 1950s, how did the lawyers, there were quite a few lawyers who were in the legislature from
Long. Yes.
What was it like working with lawyers? How did they treat people who weren't lawyers?
Oh, they were just super. The 1955 session, which is the session that I worked in, Wendell Kay was Speaker of the House. Tom Stewart, Burke Riley, Ralph Moody, Ray Plummer. Oh, I'm going to miss some. I can't remember all, but there were quite a few of them in the House. I can't remember whether Stan was in there or not. No, I don't think he was. Bob McNeely. Mm-hmm. Bob McNeely was on the sauce then, and so he wasn't given the position he should have had for his brains. Very competent legislator, very competent person, but he was on the sauce, and so Dick Gruhl got to be majority leader. That's when I really got to know Dick, although I'd known Dick here before. Dick is not a lawyer, but he's one of the very best parliamentarians around, certainly. Knew the rules, the legislature backward and forward, inside out. On the Senate side, Ralph Rivers. I can't remember so many of those. Bill Egan, of course, was there.
Mike Severich?
No. What was he? Mike came back, I guess, as a state senator. I mean, a territorial senator. Yes, he was a territorial senator then. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was the windmill.
The windmill?
The windmill. That's what we called him.
Why?
Because he'd get up and wave his arms.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Johnny Buttrevich. I'm trying to think of the people I worked with.
Did the lawyers dominate the legislative council? Was there a sense that they knew more about the way the law should be written?
The legislative council?
Or
well,
even the legislature?
The legislature, yes, they did. There were, and the Attorney General's staff, which served as their principal bill drafting agency, of course, they had nothing but attorneys working there.
Mm-hmm.
And the staff that I was with, although we drafted bills, they were always relatively simple ones, we were engaged principally in legislative research.
Mm-hmm.
And it was out of some of the basic research that I had done on population and recording districts that led to the Tom Stewart's Constitutional Convention bill.
Mm-hmm.
It created the Constitutional Convention. I drafted the first law that was the 1955 session. I'll never forget it. It was the House bill that Chapter 1, I think, of 1955 created the territorial bird. The willow ptarmigan, Lagopus lagopus, Alaskensis swarth.
So the lawyers did have a hand in legislating that. It was a lot left to the lawyers to say what the law should be.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What about J. Gerald Williams? What was he like as an attorney general?
Well, I can't really tell you how Jerry was as an AG. When Jerry, I think he was still in law school, when he was back in Juneau, his wife is, of course, from the Juneau area. And I met him when I was babysitting one summer, must have been in high school. And he was running the recreation area in Juneau. And it rained all that summer, and my little charge used to like to sit in the swings under the shed in an evergreen bowl. And Jerry taught me how to play poker. Taught Susie Wynn, myself, how to play poker. Mm-hmm. She was taking care of, I think she must have been taking care of the Ryan boy. And I was taking care of Ralph Swap, I think, that summer. We'd go meet in the bowl every day, and the kids would go out and play on the swings, and Susie and I learned to play poker. Yeah. But, you know, Jerry was a school teacher who used to teach at Hoonah. Mm-hmm. And, I can't remember what his wife's maiden name was now, but I know she was from one of the... Was she a Say? Harriet Say. Okay. So she was one of the old-time Douglas families. And, there was just somebody who was a late starter going to law school. Mm-hmm. And then when he became attorney general, you know, he's a very noisy person. Very noisy. But he's just a love of... And I haven't seen him for years, but every time I do see him, you know, it's a hug and a squeeze for one of the people he's known probably longer than most lawyers.
Did he encourage you to go to law school?
No,
he was not. Who did encourage
you? Well, it was really Paul Robeson and Wendell.
Kay. What did they say?
Oh, they didn't say anything. You know, it's just sort of, you'd be better legislative staff if you really knew what you were doing.
And,
well, you know, it wasn't said in quite those bald terms, but that was basically the idea. And, the idea was that there weren't that many women lawyers around, and they thought that I had the guts and the determination to get through law school. I guess I wanted to prove that I did have the guts and determination to get through law school. Also, I wanted to get back east again. And all the other opportunities that I had to go on, get my doctorate in history, just seemed to fall through the cracks. I would have had to change my major to get any kind of assistance that I wanted, and I didn't want to get out of Alaskan history, basically.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, completely given it up.
Oh yes. Yeah, I don't do anything at all anymore except read about it. But I had a professor at George Washington who was a specialist in overseas expansion, and he specialized in Alaska and Hawaii. And so I had a lot of encouragement in graduate school. But then, of course, when I was in law school, I was considered quite an oddity. Because it was terrible Alaskan chauvinist at Yale. But, people like Jerome Frank that I studied, I took one class from Jerome Frank, and This was at the time of the big push towards Alaskan statehood, and he'd always ask about it. James William Moore, who was from Montana himself, just thought it was neat that there was an Alaskan woman going to law school, and he was always asking questions about Alaska. Charlie Clark, who was on the Second Circuit at that time, I think I met him almost day one, and he found out I was from Alaska, and he was all wound up in the Commonwealth proceedings and for Puerto Rico, and wanted to talk to me about Alaska and the tenor of things in Alaska. Because, the Constitutional Convention was held right when I was in law school. And I'm sorry I missed that. I would have loved to have been on the staff, and I could have been very easily.
Did you get encouragement from the Juneau law firms at all? Did you ever go to them or ask to clerk for them or
no.
do anything with them at all? Even when you were doing your legislative history, did you ever?
No.
Why not?
I didn't think that they really had anything to offer me when I was doing the legislative history, because that was an area of research that I could do on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And legislative history is quite a bit different. I mean, lawyers don't very often get into it unless they've got a real question. And the legislative history of the territorial legislature is abominable. In the early territorial days, there wasn't any.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way you learned your legislative history was to read the newspapers. And that was the only way you could find out what was going on. And very careful attention to the editorial opinions of the major newspapers in the state, and particularly the Juneau Empire.
What about the lobbying efforts of many of the attorneys? And that might have been later than when your history covered.
I wouldn't have known. Well, of course, my history covered the period from 1921 to 1933. And the big lobbying effort, I don't think, came. The blackout, during the blackout period, there wasn't much going on in the way of lobbying. And, of course, Judge Arnold was the first lobbyist I remember.
What kind of reputation did he have in Juneau?
As a lobbyist?
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Everybody knew he was a very effective lobbyist. I don't know who was the lobbyist for the AJ, for example, or any of the gold mines.
Who was the attorney? Ed Hellenthal was AJ. At the AJ mine. Maybe
I don't know. I really don't know. I think that the only time I would have been involved or even would have heard of, and I don't remember who the attorneys would have been in the event that there had been a really bad mining accident.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the attorneys.
When you were done with law school, your husband lived in Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm.
You came up to Fairbanks.
Yes.
You'd been here in 46,
mm-hmm.
or 45.
45, 46, 47, then I'd gone to
GW.
And then I had come back here and graduated and stayed for a year, and then had gone back to Southeastern and outside. But we had known each other from those days. He was a doctor.
What was Fairbanks like when you first came up here?
When I first came up here in 1945,
mm-hmm.
well, it was in September, and it was overcast. From the plane, it was very beautiful. I thought, oh, those golden trees and that with the dark trees, just really, it was really spectacular. Got on the ground, and it was all muddy and dirty and uncomfortable, and I had to stay in town in order to open my bank account. And then I went out to the campus where I was expected. I had a lot of friends from Juneau on the campus. And I went out there, and the cab driver almost drove me off the road because it was so muddy and slippery. And I got onto the campus, and there was a great big hole in front of the dorm that I was to live in, and I said, turn around and take me right back to the airport. I'm going home. I'm not staying in this place. And he said, no, you just pay me for this trip. If you decide after 2 weeks you can't stand it, just call me, and I'll come pick you up and take you to the airport for nothing. And of course, you know, I just fell in love with it. Fairbanks was a very small town. The military bases were large. They were just starting to build Eielson, but Ladd Field, as it was called then, was the big thing. There was a lot of military around. It was the tail end of the Russians, and they were, you know, there were still Russians coming through, but they weren't flying planes really anymore.
So that the tail end of the Lend-Lease program.
Yes, where the planes would fly from, be brought to Fairbanks and transferred to the Russians in Fairbanks, and then they'd fly them to Nome and then to across Siberia. And one of the interpreters out at Ladd had been married to my cousin at one time. And so I got to know some of the Russian interpreters. They used to spend a lot of time out in campus. They were all young GIs for the most part. Mm-hmm. And who had Russian background. So I got to know them. There was just a lot of military around. It was a very small town. People were really very friendly. Advantages in that Andrew Nerland, for example, was a good friend of my father's. Mm-hmm. They're both Norwegians, and Norwegians dumped in the far north. And Andrew, of course, had served in the legislature for many years, and so I had friends. Alaska Link, who had served in the legislature in 41 and 43, I'm not sure. But I know she was there in 43, and maybe again in 45. And I got to know Alaska Link. And so Alaska helped introduce me into the community in Fairbanks. But we were really isolated out on the campus. We came to town whenever we could, but you know, it was a long bus ride. The old college road was just miserable in the spring. And we didn't spend a lot of time in town. We used to come in, you know, go to high school dances because they were better than the ones on the campus.
Did you know the lawyers in town? People like Warren Taylor?
No.
Had never even heard of them. I didn't know.
Well, yes, I'd heard of them. Mm-hmm. I'd heard of Collins and Clasby, mm-hmm. because I'd heard of E.B. Collins, and it was, you know, he was a name, and that was all.
Well, known from legislature, or just a territorial name?
Just a territorial name. Well, I don't know if you've talked to many people who have lived in Alaska all their lives, but when you lived in Alaska in the old territorial days, when all the travel was by ship, the ship would start out in Nome and end up in Seward and Cordova, Valdez, Cordova, Haines, Skagway, get to Juneau, and then you'd get aboard the ship. By that time, everybody knew everybody else. And by the time you got to Seattle, you know, you knew everybody on the ship. And you do this a few times, and you just knew everybody. And if you didn't know them, you knew about them. And the population was so very small. When I was in school, you know, there were 75,000 people living in Alaska. And 35,000 of those were native that you really didn't see all that much. A lot of them, you know, lived in the Arctic, you know, in the interior, in villages that you just didn't get to. So, and of course, I went to segregated schools. I didn't know Native children until I was in high school, except those that I met through friends.
Mm-hmm. So who were the big names in the state then, besides those in Juneau who you've named?
In the territory?
In the territory, yeah.
Gosh, I don't even remember their names now.
The lawyers, maybe.
Lawyers?
Yeah, lawyers. That's an arrow. Would Diamond be one of them?
Oh, yes. Yes, my father met Tony Diamond in 1912. And so and of course he was a territorial delegate from 1933 to 1945, I guess, yeah. And so I would have known Tony Diamond. Except that I later learned his name because he was on the Board of Regents of the university. So I would have known his name, but that wasn't when I was a kid.
But Collins, E.B. Collins.
E.B. Collins was a name I knew before I came to Fairbanks.
How about Odie Cochran?
Odie Cochran, I knew. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And it must have been because he was in the legislature. Mm-hmm. I would have known his name from that.
He represented all the gold mine, the gold, and known, too. Mm-hmm. Any more in the Fairbanks area?
Attorneys? Not that I knew as a child.
Sherman Noyes wouldn't be.
Well, I knew Sherman Noyes, but not as a child.
Not as a student, not as someone.
No.
When you came back in about 59? 59. Mm-hmm. Let me backtrack a little. Were you here when the court, the Integrated Bar Act passed? Can you tell me anything about what happened behind the passage of an integrated bar act, that sort of thing?
I don't even remember it now.
55, it was in the 55 legislature.
It was in the 55 legislature.
And Tom Stewart, I think, might have been one of the ones to write that.
I really honestly don't remember.
That's right.
I don't. Incidentally, Tom Stewart was one of the people that encouraged me to go to law school. Mm-hmm. And when I started talking about Eastern law schools, I did talk to him because he was the only Yale graduate around. Mm-hmm. And he thought, he was the one who suggested that it would be a good law school for me. At that point, Harvard had only had, I think, their first graduating class, only one graduating class with women in it. Mm-hmm. 50 years at least.
Years
50 years, more than 50 years. Mm-hmm. There was they graduated their first woman in the 1870s, and then they didn't have many until around the turn of the century. But they've had women on almost every graduating class since the turn of the century.
How many were in yours?
There were 13 women entering.
How many finished?
13. We didn't all finish in 3 years.
Uh-huh.
It took me 3.5 years. And I think there was one that graduated in 1960 and then one in 62.
Out of how many students?
I think our entering class was 162 or 4, something like that.
When you were up here, did you find any obstacles to your practicing because you're a woman?
No.